This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with noted attorney Burt Newborn about his new book.
It's called When at Times the Mob is Swayed. Let's see what the similarities are between Adolf Hitler and Donald Trump.
78-year-old environmental activist Maggie Herchala from Florida finds herself owing a big developer $4.4 million. All she did was speak out about a critical local environmental issue.
And that's what she got for complaining that these people were trying to sell the water from the Everglades and dry it up.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Trump was elected by about 25% of the eligible voters. Half of the voters who could have voted didn't. He lost the popular election by 3 million votes. Since then, this appalling man has proceeded to aggrandize his power, backed by large corporations to whom he gave huge tax breaks and for whom he cut regulations, the military, to whom he just gave a $750 billion budget, a Republican Supreme Court, and the right-wing media such as Sinclair Broadcasting and Fox News, he has maintained a steady base of support in the population. Increasingly, a sense of dread has spread across their country. It appears possible that Trump may get reelected. Democracy and the rule of law are increasingly threatened. Joining us today to talk about the nature of the threat and what we can do about it is constitutional lawyer Burt Newborn. He is the former legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union and has argued cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Attorney Newborn's book, When at Times the Mob is Swayed, has been recently published by the New Press. He is currently the Norman Dorson Professor of Civil Liberties at NYU School of Law.
Professor Burt Newborn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why did you choose the line from a Robert Frost poem, When at Times the Mob is Swayed, as the title for your book?
Well, it's a poem that Frost wrote in 1916 called Something Like a Star. And he was writing it in the midst of the hysteria that surrounded American entry into World War I and the jailing of protesters and the extraordinary overreaction against dissent. And the I took the line from a quatrain in the poem that says, "When at times the mob is swayed to carry praise or blame too far, we may choose something like a star to stay our mind on and be stayed." And so he was really urging people to commit to principle, stay with principle, and not allow the mob to push you in one direction or another.
The similarities between fascist dictator Adolf Hitler and President Donald Trump are alarming. You don't equate the two, but you do point out many similarities in the book, and we'd like to discuss that. Is it a misconception to believe that Hitler took power by force?
Oh, absolutely. Germany fell into Hitler's lap like ripe, rotten fruit from a tree. Hitler never obtained more than about 35% in any free election, and he didn't use the army to seize power. What he essentially did was took power as a minority chancellor in 1933, and then between 1933 and 1936 executed a series of rhetorical acts of satanic genius in which he persuaded the German people to let him govern essentially uncontrolled. Now, he used violence. He used the Reichstag fire as an excuse to suppress dissent. So it isn't as though he didn't use violence, but he didn't overthrow the Weimar Republic. It fell into his lap, and it fell into his lap because he was an evil genius at being able to divide people, to create tropes, to create the rhetoric that tore apart the fabric that held the Weimar Republic together.
Let's talk about Trump's bedside reading. It's been reported that Hitler's 1941 collection of speeches, My New Order, was in the drawer next to Trump's bed.
Well, that's what his first wife testified. His first wife at Trump's first divorce trial, his first wife testified that he had a copy of My New Order on his bedstand. Michael Kennedy, who was her lawyer, corroborated that that's what she said. This is a pattern, of course. Trump has now sealed that testimony. That testimony is now sealed. No one will ever see it. But I saw it before it was sealed. And Michael Kennedy, who was the lawyer, reported it as well. So it's a fact. I mean, he had a copy on. He admits it. He says he didn't read it. It was given to him as a gift, and he just left it on his bedstand.
It's a decoration.
Yeah.
Why and how are our democratic checks and balances being pushed to the brink?
Well, the questions you asked me about comparing Trump and Hitler are really the answer to that, and it's why I wrote the book. I want to be clear. I'm not comparing Trump and Hitler as people. I think it's a mistake to use kind of facile comparison and compare people to Hitler. Hitler was a satanic, evil force that caused more loss, grief, and tragedy than almost anything else I can imagine. And to compare current people with that level of force, in some sense, trivializes it. It trivializes the genocide. It trivializes the massive evil that he did. On the other hand, you can't close your eyes to the fact that what Trump is doing and did in his campaign in 2016 and is doing now is just taking a page out of the book, out of the Hitler's speeches, and using the same tropes. So when I compare the two, I don't compare the two as people, and I don't compare the two as policy. I compare the two as rhetorical actors who understand how to use language and use mass communication to divide people, and by dividing them, gain more power for themselves. For example, one remarkable example is one of the very early speeches that Hitler gave after he became chancellor. It was a speech in which he complained about something that he called the Lügenpresse. The Lügenpresse was his description of the mainstream press in Germany, all of which was against him and all of which treated him as a buffoon and a ridiculous blowhard, just the way many people treat Trump. He was complaining about that, and he said it's the Lügenpresse, and Lügenpresse translates in two ways. You can translate it two ways. It translates lying press, or it translates fake news. And the fact is, that book on his bedstand, on Trump's bedstand, taught him how to deal with a mainstream press that was attacking him by simply claiming that they were lying. And it's part of an extraordinary and very dangerous notion that Trump shares with Hitler. Hitler wanted to dissolve the idea of objective fact. So he would say that the mainstream press was lying. You can't believe anything he said. Then he attacked his scientists, and the scientists were lying unless science advanced his policies. And he just kept on pounding at the idea that there was no such thing as objective truth. It was only the truth that the people would accept. So everything was grist for a populist jury. And when you think about it, Trump does that all the time. Trump claims that he'll make assertions like how many people attended his inauguration, and he says it was the most in history. When in fact, the objective count means that that was not true. But he keeps on repeating it, and he says it's a lie if you don't accept it. He says it's his weather forecasters, the really extraordinarily good scientists and the meteorology folks, said that the hurricane was not going to hit Alabama. Trump said it was going to hit Alabama, and then when it was proved that he was wrong, he forced his scientists to eat their words and say, no, objective truth means nothing. It's what I say that matters. And that's a dangerous trope that he shares with Hitler.
Yeah, alternative facts.
Yeah, and the alternative facts are the facts that the leader says are true, and he can persuade enough of the people to buy onto, and all of a sudden, they become true by some sort of magic alchemy. And I'm also glad you asked about the comparison between Hitler and Trump. I was warned not to put that stuff in the book. not threatened, but warned by well-meaning people who said, Bert, if you put that stuff in your book, no one is getting beyond chapter two. Chapter two is where the comparison is. He says, that's all anybody's going to want to talk about. That's all the attention is going to get sucked into that chapter. And in fact, unfortunately, there's some truth to that. What I really urge people to do is get beyond two. The whole reason I wrote chapter two was to tell you why I'm so frightened and to tell you why we have to be so aware of the weaknesses in our institutional structure, because the institutional structure is going to be under pressure from Trump in ways that it's never been under pressure before, because he is such a genius at the kind of divisive communication that he specializes in. And that puts huge pressure on the democratic institutions. The Weimar institutions cracked. Now, the question is, will our institutions crack? And I think they won't. But they won't only if we recognize the danger to them and reinforce the institutions.
We're speaking with law professor Bert Newborn, who's just written When at Times the Mob is Swayed.
In addition to rhetorical tropes, there are other points of comparison between Hitler and Trump. For example, it was enlightening to read in your book that Hitler gave out free radios. What was the purpose of that, and how does it compare, if you think it does, to Trump's Twitter activity?
Oh, well, that's a great question, Heidi. There was a breakthrough in 1931 in radio technology. Prior to 1931, radios were big, galumphing things because you had to have huge tubes so that the radios were large. In 1931, in Berlin, there was a breakthrough in miniaturization. You could make small radio tubes and small radios. And the Nazi Party was one of the first to recognize it. In Yad Vashem, in Jerusalem, in the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, there were two innocuous-looking green cubes, green plastic cubes, on tables. You walk past them because they're not very prepossessing. You would walk right past them. I stopped one day and read the card on the table, and the card said, "These are examples of the radios that the Nazi Party gave out in 1932, beginning in 32, in Berlin. And they were free. There was only one catch. They only received one frequency, and the frequency was Adolf Hitler's voice. And so this was an enormous technological breakthrough where a charismatic leader could speak directly to large numbers of people with no mediating institution. No editorial, no chance to get back. The words left Hitler's mouth and rattled around inside the heads of the people who were listening to those radios. And a steady diet of that every single day from a master puppeteer, I think, began to move people. And I said, then I thought to myself, is there a 21st century analog to those green plastic radios? And the 21st century analog, I said, oh my God, it's Trump's Twitter account. Because you have to recognize, he was one of the first to realize that politicians could communicate directly with the mass audience, going around the media, going around the press, speaking directly to the heads of the people who were receiving the information. And I said, that's the analogy. The analogy is the technological breakthrough that enables him to speak directly to 60 million people as though they are in a room with him, just the way Hitler was able to speak to 60 million people. Now, anybody can do it, but the thing that we have to acknowledge is that Hitler was a genius at it, and Trump is pretty damn good at
yeah.
it. At least for me, when I put together all the points of comparison, the use of Lugan Press, the slogan, Hitler ran on a slogan in which he promised to make Germany great again. The slogan and the lying press and the misogyny and the racial dog whistles. I mean, this is a president who has managed to make hurricane aid to Puerto Rico into a race issue because he finds the edge, he finds the racial edge in everything and divides us on that basis. So when you put that kind of similarity together with the technological breakthrough, Then I said to myself, American institutions are going to take a pounding from this like nothing they have ever experienced before. I said, and it's about time for us to give those institutions a stress test to see how well they'll survive. And that's what my book is. My book is a stress test for American institutions and a series of recommendations for how we can reinforce those institutions.
The book is called When at Times the Mob is Swayed by law professor Bert Newborn.
Did both Trump and Hitler help or enable large corporations to cement their rule of power?
Sure. There's a remarkable comparison between Hitler's version of fascism, and fascism generally, but Hitler's version and Mussolini's version of fascism used corporations essentially as de facto governance structures. They actually governed through the delegation of enormous power to corporations, who then exercised that power to order the economy and order the way people worked. And so in a fascist regime, corporations really should be seen as an engine of the state. Volkswagen, for example, was a corporation that was chartered by the Reichstag and actually functioned as an organ of the state. After the Second World War, when reparations were being thought of, it was very complicated to deal with Volkswagen because they didn't know whether it was a private corporation or a government organ. And many, many corporations operated that way. Trump, of course, has, in the modern era, has empowered American corporations more than any other president that I can think about. He showered wealth on them with the tax bill. He's pulled away most of the restrictions that would protect the environment. He is hostile to anything that would protect workers against exploitation. And so we're living in a society now where corporations are empowered to create and exercise immense influence over how we live. And, you know, culminating, of course, Trump didn't do this, but the forces that Trump is unleashing did it. The Supreme Court then tells us that corporations can speak, and they have First Amendment rights just like everybody else. I hadn't realized that a corporation was going to move in next to me and just put its arm around me and tell me that it was my friend. I didn't know corporations were people, but the Supreme Court seems to think they're people. And they can speak, and there's no way that you can regulate that. And not only that, in the Hobby Lobby case, They went so far as to say that a corporation has a soul and can exercise religious freedom rights. So you've got corporations praying. You've got corporations, and by the way, praying in two ways, praying to their God and praying on the rest of us. The immense power of the corporate state is something that existed in both Weimar Germany and the United States. Now, again, I want to be very clear. The United States is not Weimar Germany. Weimar had no tradition of democratic governance. Germany, it was very thin. The Weimar Republic was imposed on Germany at the end of the First World War. It's unclear how much support there was for democratic governance in Germany ever during that period. And they were in the midst of the Great Depression. So they were facing massive economic problems. They were facing what was an unfair treaty. The Treaty of Versailles was an unfair treaty, and there was no real democratic tradition in Germany. So Hitler found it relatively easy to push the Weimar Republic over. No one is going to find it easy to push American democracy over.
I wanted just to mention both Hitler and Trump's glorifying the military, but let me ask you this. What about both of these men's attacks on the rule of law, on the separation of powers, on the judiciary?
Well, one of the ways that Hitler took power in 1930s was to dissolve the power of parliament. He used the Reichstag fire as an excuse to declare a national emergency, words that Trump has learned very well. He declared a national emergency, seized the power to act unilaterally as the chancellor, and the courts didn't stop him. Once he had done that, by the 1936 Olympics, by the 1936 Berlin Olympics, in 3 years, he had essentially eroded all of Weimar's democratic institutions and all of the protections of separation of powers. One of the things I talk about in my book is the very dangerous response of the Supreme Court to Trump's assertion of the power to act unilaterally. Reasonable people can agree or disagree about whether we have a rational immigration policy. Reasonable people can agree or disagree about whether we need a border wall or whether tariffs should be raised or lowered. I mean, when I think of the substantive policies that Trump is pursuing, those are policies that in a democracy, reasonable people will deal with. But they are policies that should be put into place by Congress, not unilaterally by a president saying it's a national emergency and I get to rule alone. There you're beginning to flirt with real danger. When you begin to give that kind of power to a megalomaniacal person like Trump, who sees the world through his own ego, and you take away all the checks, and the judiciary doesn't respond. They learn a new word called deference, and then they just roll over and let Trump scratch their belly. If that's what we're going to see, that the center-right Republican Party folds up in Congress, Trump then just ignores Congress, and the courts don't stop him, that's a recipe for danger. Now, I don't say it's, you know, I don't say Trump is intending it. I don't think this is what he wants. I don't think he has within his intellectual apparatus. I don't think he has the capacity to think through that way. He thinks it in very short-term things. What's good for me? What gets me the best ratings? What advances my chance of winning in 2020? That's all he's thinking about. But he's running around like a bull in a china shop and knocking over institutions that are designed to protect American democracy.
He's puerile.
Well, I think he's the first two-year-old president. I mean, I remember how my kids acted it, too. They would scream until they got their ice cream. And I have a hunch that we have a president who screams until he gets his ice cream.
What about Trump and Hitler's rejection of international norms, like the Paris Climate Accord or the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, that's another similarity between Trump's policies and Hitler's policies. Hitler despised internationalism, probably for good reason. Internationalism is how the Treaty of Versailles took Germany at the end of the First World War and really imposed, I think, dreadfully unfair sanctions on them in a way that eventually caused such resentment that there was a revolution against it. That's the way Trump dealt with international. He thought all international relations were based on power. The power, not on the sort of common good, not on an effort to get together in collective enterprise, but what a single state could do to advance its policies. And he had this vision of a world in which it was a closed pie. Whatever Germany got, somebody else lost. There was no way to get together and make the pie bigger. It was a fixed pie. And Trump behaves that way, too. Trump mistrusts internationalism. Even NATO, which is the most successful international military alliance in world history, he threatened to pull us out. He's constantly denigrating NATO, pulled out of the climate accords, pulled out of the nuclear treaty with Iran. He simply doesn't trust international institutions. He trusts only in American power. Now, we could have a debate about that, about whether that's good foreign policy or bad foreign policy. I happen to think it's dangerous foreign policy. But it's Trump's idea of the world is an embattled America in which the rest of the world is trying to pick our pocket. And what we have to do is lash back out at them, either by raising tariffs and starting a trade war or by increasing militarization to the point we threaten them militarily. But the last thing he'll ever do is compromise with them and try to work out a deal where everybody gets a little bit more.
We just have a few minutes remaining, but we want to talk about your specific proposals to strengthen democracy. In the USA, we don't have one person, one vote.
No.
Why And what would you suggest we
do? We have to come to grips with as a people with the fact that the Constitution is deeply flawed that way. The only way they could get a constitution in 1787 and 1789 was to make a deal with the devil, and that was to protect slavery and bring the southern states in, or else there would never have been a United States. Part of the deal with the southern states was to promise the southern states that they would have the same representation in the Senate, regardless of population. And so every state gets two senators, doesn't matter how many people there are. And that tilts the political world in the United States toward rural America, sparsely populated rural America, that just happens to be white. So if you take Wyoming with 600,000 people, 97% of whom are white. If you take Wyoming with 600,000 people, Wyoming gets two senators. California, with 40 million people of enormous diversity, also gets two senators. That's a 65-1 violation of the one-person, one-vote. There are many states where it's 20-1. New York is more than 20-1. California is more than 20-1. One person, one vote violation. Pennsylvania, Illinois. The states of urban America are the states that get hurt this way. And it tilts the political system toward rural voters. It gives rural voters more say in the Senate. And that then carries over to give rural voters more say in the Electoral College. Because the Electoral College, the indirect way we elect the president, allocates electors by how many senators and representatives you have. So if you have two senators, you get two electors, even if you don't have any people. So Wyoming has three electors, one representative, two senators, which means that they have a disproportionate amount of power in choosing who the next president is. And that's why, in the 21st century, the Republican Party has lost the popular vote in both 2000 and 2016, but nevertheless elected their candidate. They elected Bush in 2000. They elected Trump in 2016. And 2020, the Republican Party will certainly lose the popular vote. There isn't any question that they will lose the popular vote by millions, but they have a real chance to really win the presidency because Trump can thread the needle with white rural states that will give him enough electoral votes to become the president.
We're speaking with Bert Newborn, who's just written When at Times the Mob is Swayed, an excellent book. We recommend that our listeners get it.
We could go on for another half hour. Unfortunately, we can't. What kind of extra legal resistance do you suggest in the book?
I don't suggest it. I have the final chapter is called Night Sweats. I mean, the body of the book is a series of recommendations about how to increase voter turnout, how to understand how judicial review works, how to get rid of partisan gerrymandering. I mean, all the things that I think many people know we have to do in order to fix the democracy. And then I say, in the end, what if it doesn't work? What if I'm wrong? What if the romantic optimist in me turns out to just be wrong? And that's, I call the chapter Night Sweats. And I think through all of the scenarios. Trump loses the 2020 election, but claims that he loses the 2020 election because of undocumented aliens who cast phony votes. And he says he's not going to step aside because that would mean a trashing democracy. And I have in the book, he asks Attorney General Giuliani to engage in an investigation of the election. But he said, until then, I'm not stepping aside. And he just says...
That's what his lawyer said he'd do.
Yeah, well, he threatened it. He threatened it in 2016. I said, what if he actually does it? Or worse, what if he just ran, you know, a kind of befuddled Joe Biden? What if he just takes him into custody? And takes Biden 2 days to figure out he's been taken into custody and just ends the election? What would we do? And the one thing we can't do, the one thing that it is absurd to think about doing, is to resist by violence. That's a trap. It's a trap in which people will die and nothing will happen. That's the left wing's view of the right wing's vision about why they have guns. They claim that the Second Amendment guarantees the right to have guns so that they can defend themselves against the government with hunting rifles. They're going to defend themselves against tanks. It's an absurd view. And it would be equally absurd for the left to think that they can resist violently. But you don't have to resist violently. There are nonviolent resistance mechanisms that I speculate about. This is not going to happen. If you come to my house tonight, I will give you a written promise that this will not happen. That our institutions will hold and that we will never have to do extra legal defense of democracy. But there are mass strikes. There are sit-downs. The thing that I think would be the most interesting thing was to harness federalism and to get the states to simply go into resistance to the federal government. For example, suppose the states decided that instead of paying your federal taxes directly to the federal government, you paid your federal taxes to a state office that checked the return for accuracy and then sent the money into the federal government. Well, suppose the money didn't get to the federal government and the states actually began to starve it. I mean, one of the extraordinary things that happens in America today is the very group that's underrepresented, urban America, is where all the ideas are. It's where the economic engine of a country is. It is what drives the country forward. And that urban America bleeds money to rural America. We essentially finance the lifestyle of the people in rural America who claim that the government is their enemy, when it's in fact the only thing that keeps most of them alive. And if that flow of money were ever cut off because we stopped paying taxes for it, you'd be surprised how fast there'd be a change in politics. So and it would depend upon having courageous local and state officials who would step into the breach and attempt to restore democracy. But let me say again, it's not going to happen. It's my science fiction chapter at the end of the chapter.
Bert Newborn, it's been a pleasure for Heidi and I to be able to speak with you today.
How can listeners read what you've...
Oh, well, there's a webpage at NYU. NYU Law School, where I've taught for 48 years now, has a webpage in which the writings of all of the faculty are listed and available. I warn you, there are 82 articles, and once you start, I'll keep tabs of you to make sure that you read every one of them. But you can go to the webpage at NYU and Great. Get free access to virtually all.
And what is that citation?
Google NYU.
Yeah. NYU School of Law.
Yeah.
Bert Newborn, you've written, "When at times the mob is swayed, we urge everybody to go out and get a copy." And Heidi and I thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Issues of the environment, citizen advocacy, and the public's right to know are converging in two South Florida court cases. One involves 78-year-old Maggie Hirchala, a former Everglade Coalition's Conservationist of the Year and winner of a National Wetlands Award from the Environmental Law Institute. Her sister was Janet Reno, former Attorney General under the Clinton administration. Now, she owes a developer $4.4 million for speaking out about a critical local environmental issue. In 2012, Hirchala, whose sister was Janet Reno, learned that Lake Point Restoration was considering conveying water to West Palm Beach for a fee. She complained about the company's operation in emails to Martin County commissioners. After it lost out on some contracts, Lake Point claims that Maggie lied and was intent on hurting the company. In a second related case, the nonprofit Everglades Law Center requested a transcript of a closed-door meeting of South Florida Water Management's governing board. Their response was to haul the law center into court, with Maggie added to the lawsuit. Joining us to discuss these two cases is Richard Grosso, Director of Environmental and Land Use Practice at Nova Southeastern University. Professor Grosso is a widely recognized legal expert, practicing attorney and policy advocate, with over 3 decades' experience litigating and advocating on statewide and South Florida environmental issues. Richard, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, good morning.
Morning. Richard, for the Northerners and people outside of Florida, could you describe the environmental situation in Martin County?
Well, Martin County's been, for many years, one of those places where old Florida, well-preserved, meets development and activity pressure from Southeast Florida that has continued to encroach on it. So Martin County has always been sort of at the leading edge of how strongly we are going to interpret and apply our environmental laws and growth management laws against development pressure and pressure for extraction of resources that's coming from other parts of the state. And it's been kind of a bellwether for how well good, strong environmental and land use protections are going to hold up in the face of pressure. So it's always created a lot of conflicts there. A lot of important legal cases and controversies have come out of Martin County over the last couple of decades.
And for those who don't know the geography that well, we're talking about the West Palm Beach area?
Martin County is the county, yes, just north of West Palm Beach.
And I understand there's been a history of drought there.
Well, you know, like everywhere in South Florida, we have 2 seasons. We have rainy and we have dry. And so during the summer months, we have more water than we can handle. During the dry season, however, we don't have enough water, and that's all really been a function of how much wetlands, how much land we have lost in the system in mainland Florida from ditching, draining, losing it to development, and that sort of thing. You know, the water levels used to work for the amount of land we had to hold on to water during the summer, and then it was available in the winter. Since we cut up and drained and ditched and diked Southeast Florida, we no longer can store that water during the rainy season, so it's available for the dry season because we flush it out to the ocean to get rid of it so we can keep farms and homes, quite frankly, you know, artificially dry during the wet season.
We want to talk about Maggie Herchala, who is a longtime environmental activist. And I know she was also Martin County's first female commissioner back in 1974, a liberal Democrat in what we understand is a town of Republicans. And she had a famous sister. Is that in part why, when we describe the lawsuits, it seems that she's been credited with having great influence over some of the decisions recently?
Well, she has always been a leading, informed, talented voice for environmental protection in South Florida. And one of the reasons that she was elected and maintained her role as a leader in Martin County for many years is that a lot of the folks in Martin County, voters and citizens who are Republicans, have always really understood the importance of protecting the environment. A lot of those folks moved to Martin County because it was a really special place. And so for most of the time that Maggie has been a leader and other folks in that county, protecting the nature of Martin County and protecting its nature has been a bipartisan issue for a long time. You had a lot of very good Republican elected officials who understood that. There has, for whatever reason, been a backlash in that county in recent years where local leaders have undone a lot of the historic protections for the environment and for the rural areas in that county, and that has resulted in a lot of the activity, the lawsuits, the clashes that we've seen in recent years, and it's really been incredibly unfortunate.
The company Lake Point in 2008 bought 2,200 acres of former sugarcane fields in the western fringes of Martin County near Lake Okeechobee. Along with the other company, American Water, what was Lake Point's restoration plan in terms of diverting, cleansing, and selling that water?
Well, I don't know. You'll have to ask them what their plan was. What we know was that when they first entered into an agreement with the government agencies down here, it was contemplated that when they were done with those mines, that that water would then be used, the water that sits in those big open pits would then be used as part of a Everglades restoration project. Somehow after the company sued those agencies, alleging a breach of that agreement, and sued Ms. Urchella, the agencies settled the case and they changed that contract, and it no longer explicitly contemplated that those spent mining pits and the water in them would be used as part of an Everglades restoration project. So I think that was what led to the controversy, as any alert citizen ought to do. She started asking questions. What's going on here? Why have you concluded that this is what you're going to do with this project? And from the very beginning, she was raising questions about, it seems dubious that you should be allowing mines on the theory that they're going to help Everglades restoration later anyway, because the science doesn't seem to support that. And it was those kinds of statements that resulted in her being sued by the company. And ultimately, apparently a jury decided that her statements about the environmental nature of the property and her statements about how well the water management concept had been studied were not accurate. And upon that theory, the jury apparently found that she had lied. Now, the key set of issues that I think is important for people to understand there, and these were issues that we wrote about in our friend of the court briefs, is that scientific conclusions are inherently debatable. Whether an area is still a wetland after it's had several years of impact, whether a water management project will effectively help restore the environment or not. These things are inherently debated by science. They're highly technical, highly complex. There's almost always at least two sides to that story when you get into these complex scientific conclusions. And the leap that this case has made that has got to be really concerning for people is, you know, typically when you lose that environmental fight, you through some sort of court case or an administrative hearing, and one side puts up an expert witness that says, oh, it's a wetland and it's an important wetland, and the other side puts up an expert witness that says, well, it's not really a wetland or it's a really highly degraded wetland, whoever loses that case, you lose the permit. You know, you lose the policy decision. To take the step far now and say, oh, and you lied when you were asserting that it was a high-quality wetland or when you were asserting it wasn't a good water management project, not only do you lose the case and you lose another chunk of natural Florida to some other use, but you're now liable for damages because of the money that you cost that entity that had that relationship with government. That's the really concerning part of this case for people who are trying to advocate, you know, not just on environmental issues. This could be a human health issue or anything that's the subject of, you know, complex, uncertain, debatable science. And that's why this has become such a visible case and so concerning for a lot of people.
I'm reading some of the comments from the court, Richard. It seems that Maggie Herchala sent emails to the five county commissioners, and the appeals court said, from those emails, the jury can conclude that Herchala intentionally, or at the least with reckless disregard, made purportedly factual statements to induce the commissioners not to go forward with its contract. Aren't we just talking about a citizen writing to elected officials to express what we think is First Amendment protected activity? She didn't do anything to induce stopping the contract.
Well, in fact, many of the points she had been raising to her elected officials were similar points that had been raised by their own government staff people. Yes, the short answer to your question is yes. She was asserting her positions and raising her issues to her duly elected officials. The notion that that is wrong, that there was something improper to do that, was really very troubling. I think the court focused on the fact that she sent some of those emails to private email addresses of her county commissioners as opposed to public. There's nothing wrong with that. You're allowed to do that. Those documents are public record under Florida law. Even if you send an email to a government official's private email server, it's a public record. It's their duty to preserve it. But a citizen hasn't done anything wrong by emailing a commissioner at a private email server. The court also pointed to some of her language, her flip language, and phrases that she used. If you know Maggie Urshela, you know that she's quite the character, and that's how she talks. And I would think that there's lots of people with a little flair, a little personality, a little sarcasm to them. And the notion that you no longer have a First Amendment right to be sarcastic, to be flip, to speak the way you speak authentically is a really concerning part of all of this. And finally, ultimately, the most troubling thing about this, beyond what I've already talked about, is that a citizen would feel like, I've got to hire a lawyer before I send an email. I've got to hire a lawyer before I send a letter. I've got to make sure I'm not doing any of the things that somebody taking it out of context later could argue is improper. If I've got a perspective on something, if I've just read a study that says something, I'm not allowed to tell that to my government officials unless I first research whether or not, you know, there's a contrary study that might conflict with that. And I first have to research how smart or informed my elected officials are, because if they don't really know much about the issue, it might be seen later or argued later that I was taking advantage of my superior knowledge and trying to unduly influence them. Those kinds of issues, when you read the opinion, are really concerning. I do think it's important, though, for people to know that this case does not mean you cannot speak anymore. You do have the First Amendment right to petition your governmental officials. You do have the First Amendment right to speak out. My best advice for people would be keep it plain, keep it vanilla. Just say, this is what I've learned, this is what I've seen a study or report talk about. No, I'm not the world's greatest expert on it. I haven't had the chance to do exhaustive research to know if there's other studies out there, but I'm bringing this to your attention. I think that it would be tragic if people stopped advocating their positions to their government officials, stopped communicating with them. Just be succinct, be clear about what you know and what you don't know. Raise questions. You absolutely have a First Amendment right to raise questions. If you're not sure if something's true, but you have reason to think it might be, then just raise the issue. Hey, have you all investigated this? Are you sure that X, Y, or Z isn't happening about this issue? So I really want to get that message to people that you continue to have that First Amendment right. It is the most important right you have in a democratic society like ours. And be like Maggie Urshela. Do not back down. Do not be intimidated. Do smart things to protect yourself. Certainly Maggie did, in my view, nothing wrong in this case. It's a really bad decision.
Yeah, I'll say. And we're speaking with Richard Grosso, who's an environmental attorney in Florida, about the case of Maggie Urshela, who was found guilty of interfering with a contract and hit with a $4.4 million fine for writing a couple of letters. It certainly has a chilling effect on citizens' right to protest what they see as wrong.
Richard, there's another case involving the Everglades Law Center after it requested a transcript of a closed-door meeting of the South Florida Water Management District governing board members who were discussing settling the Lake Point lawsuit. Now, instead of producing the document or saying why it was exempt from public record laws, the district actually sued, saying it wanted a judge's opinion, and it forced the law center to court. Herchala was added to the lawsuit when she made a similar records request, which I understand we all have a right to do. And the district also threatened to subpoena emails between Herchala and the law center, as well as 16 other Floridians who also asked for the record of what was said in that meeting. How is the law center responding to being hauled into court?
As you and I speak, about 10 minutes ago, I got a copy of the court order in that appeal. And the Fourth District Court of Appeal has just ruled, as of early this morning, the Water Management District was wrong to not give up to the public the entire transcript of its settlement meeting, but that any part of the settlement meeting where the lawyer for the governing board of the district talked to the governing board about the settlement, any part of that revealed confidential mediation discussions between Lake Point and the district would be exempt from the Public Records Act, and it sent the case back to the trial court for the trial court to require the Water Management District to give up the transcript, and then the trial court to redact any parts that discussed confidential mediation statements, and then turn over the rest of the transcript of that hearing to the Everglades Law Center and the other people who had requested the documents. So that's brand new breaking news that just happened. I will say, I think it's important to say that thankfully the South Florida Water Management District Governing Board is a new governing board now, newly appointed by the new governor of Florida, and it has quickly demonstrated itself to be a very different governing board than the prior one. It has changed the relationship between citizenry and the district, and I don't think today's governing board would have done what that old governing board did and actually sued citizens for looking for documents. We will at some point soon know what was said, at least partially, in that settlement agreement meeting between the old governing board and the company, and hopefully that'll shed some light on why the prior agency had settled its case with the mining company and left Ms. Herchala out there standing alone to ask questions and raise issues about what was a questionable and controversial mining project.
Reminds me of that great movie Chinatown with Jack Nicholson about the corruption of the water authority in Los Angeles. But I'm not going to talk about corruption here. Richard Grosso, I wanted to ask you, you've written that Florida is battling global warming and sea level rise and the loss of biodiversity, so we can't afford to be quiet. What's at risk with these two cases?
Well, what's at risk with these two cases is the ability of people who don't have, and that's most of us, direct large financial stakes in the outcome of major environmental decisions to play a role. If you are like most people in Florida and you are concerned about the future of your state, you're worried about your children and your grandchildren's health because of what's happening with warming oceans, you have to be concerned that if you speak up and that costs some company a lot of money, because maybe it delayed their project because we had to investigate the potential problems or whatever, you have to worry about that, and your voice may not get heard as a result of that. But, you know, folks, individuals, and companies that have means don't need to be quite concerned about asserting themselves. And so you worry at a time when we need as many people raising issues and insisting that their government protect the future of our state than we've ever had before, that the very people whose way of life and future is at stake are going to lose the ability to raise issues. And you've got to mention, if you're talking about that, that we are facing this existential problem of existential crisis of global warming, and it is the subject of probably the most uncertain, the most debatable science in terms of the details of exactly what's going to happen of any issue we've ever dealt with in the globe, in the country, certainly in the state. And so if people are going to be penalized financially for raising issues about like the human health impacts and the ecological impacts and the water impacts, just to name a few, of global warming, and that turns out to have been not exactly correct, that they have to worry that they now will be found to have lied when, you know, they are repeating statements they've seen in studies and repeating statements they've seen of experts. So, you know, to me, the answer has got to be that all people, Republican, Democrat, Independent, people who I think we would all agree, you have a right to speak up and have your voice heard by government. I think everybody needs to rally around and defend the right of anybody else to have a robust discussion about everything that's going on in the state and defend everyone else's right to say those things. Otherwise, if we are simply reliant on people currently in government and the people with the greatest amount of economic sway with government, if those are the only voices heard, I sincerely doubt we're going to be able to bring to bear the information and the perspectives that we have to, and quickly, for government to make sure we're actually going to be able to continue to live here.
Richard, how can our listeners learn more about your work and some of the work of the many environmental groups that you've helped provide a voice for?
The groups that we've worked with on this case, certainly Everglades Law Center is one of the leading public interest law firms in Florida, and that's a good place to start. Watch what they're doing. Support groups like that if you can. If you live in Florida part-time, you know, realize that you have a stake here and try to make your voice heard by our elected officials, and that's important. We have a lot of part-time people who live here because they love Florida. If they treat it as their home and assert themselves in a way that makes sure that government knows that they're expected to protect this place, that'll go a long way towards helping us out.
Richard Grosso, it's been really a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for making the time. And we're thinking of Maggie and all of the groups down in Florida and wishing everyone the best.
Thank you all.
Yeah.
Take care.
Thanks so much, Richard. You take it easy.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.